Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A radical departure from Orthodoxy today, the usual two segments, but two guests in each. Paul North and Paul Reiter will talk about their new translation of the first volume of Marx's Capital, and Nimrod Flaschenberg and Alma Itzhaki will report on the vicious political environment that's prevailed in Israel over the year since the October 7th attacks. There are two existing translations of the first volume of Marx's Capital, which people sometimes refer to by its German title, Das Kapital. That practice has always mystified me. You don't hear people citing Günter Grass's great 1959 novel, The Tin Drum, as Die Blechtrommel. Is there something irredeemably German about Marx's masterpiece? Something threatening that must be kept at a distance? Back to the translations. The first edition in English, translated by Samuel Moore and Edward Aveling, and supervised by Friedrich Engels, appeared in 1887. A newer translation by Ben Fowkes was published in 1977, usually referred to as the vintage edition. And now a new translation is out, creating quite a splash among Marx aficionados, this from Princeton University Press, with Paul Reiter as translator and editor and Paul North as editor. This edition is part of a torrent. There's been an explosion in translations of Capital into other languages as well, a product of a revived interest in a writer who's been pronounced dead more times than neoliberalism. Here to talk about their edition and the importance of the book more generally are the two Pauls. Paul North is a professor of German at Yale, and Paul Reiter, a professor of German at Ohio State. I'll start with the question I'm sure everyone asks you. Why a new translation of Capital? What need is being satisfied here?
Well, just like your book wears out, a translation wears out. It is a product of its time, to some degree, and the product of certain interpretations of the work. So it needed to be retranslated partly because the work has been understood in a vastly different way in the last 25 years, and even at the times that Fowkes was translating it. It has been understood as part of a much bigger project than just Volume 1, or even than just Volume 1 through 3, that tries to take account of the entire Capital system. And that is about value rather than being about class struggle. That is not only a dialectical work, but uses a whole host of logics and speaks in a number of styles. So Reiter can talk to this in really genius terms, but it takes a special ear to catch all of Marx's styles. And all of his styles are critical and philosophical and hard-hitting and good attacks on Capital.
It's kind of hard to select which edition, which text to use, right? Describe some of those challenges.
Yeah, so as Paul says, the edition that we use, the 1872 edition, that's the second German edition of Capital, is not necessarily authoritative, but it's authorized. And that is to say that this is the last German edition whose publication Marx himself oversaw. But there really is no single authoritative edition. There are four German editions. The first edition appeared in 1867. Marx made a lot of changes when he prepared the second German edition for publication. That appeared again in 1872. And then after he died, his friend and writing partner, Friedrich Engels, put out two editions, the third edition and the fourth edition. And there's also an important French edition that Marx helped translate into French, which appeared in 1875. And because that's actually the last edition whose publication process Marx himself oversaw, there are some people who think that that's really the best edition to use. But there are a lot of problems with that claim, which we discuss a bit in our front matter. And it's also discussed in the back matter as well. We take the French edition very seriously, its importance, but we're also alive to its problems. And we discuss them at some length for the people who are, you know, really, really into philological questions.
This multiplicity of editions says something about Marx's style of thinking, doesn't it? I think Paul Valéry said that a poem is never finished, only abandoned. And Marx couldn't abandon a text. He was constantly changing it, but that's because his thinking was constantly evolving, right?
Nicely put. I would modify Valéry's statement for Marx and say, a critique of Capital is never finished. It's just continued. And he continued and continued and continued. He revised Volume 1. He had already written drafts of Volume 2 and 3. You have to remember that this is part of an attempt to, like the Gospels in the Bible, look at the Capital system synoptically. The volume that we've translated now is on production. Volume 2, which we're working on, is on circulation. And volume 3 is on the system as a whole, including all the complicated movements of profit and goods from one sector of the economy to the other. So imagine what it meant for him to sit on this giant elephant and try to ride it around. You had to get to know it. It took him 20 years or so to organize himself to even write publishable versions of it.
What is the division of labor between the two of you? You were both listed as editors and writer as a translator, but what were your editorial roles and what exactly did each of you do with the text?
This was writer's idea. He is really a phenomenal translator, and I would say particularly of German Jewish writing with all of its humor, philosophical incisiveness, and critical potential. And he cut his teeth translating Salomon Maimon, Karl Kraus, names that might not be so well known, but are incredibly trenchant critics of Europe, of everything, really. If Marx called for the ruthless critique of everything standing, then Karl Kraus actually did that. Reiter was ready to do this, had the idea, and they brought me on board. And he really did the most amazing thing, which is sit for hours a day for years, going sentence by sentence, translating the text and trying to find a voice for it. I contributed to the translation by debating him on certain issues, by comparing it to the German. And together we decided what kind of capital we wanted to put into the world. And we wrote notes, many critical, informative endnotes from the editors to try and open up the text for people who don't understand from the beginning what Marx is trying to do.
There was a kind of arc to the collaboration. Initially, I spent a lot of time on my own working on the translation, trying out different strategies. I would run things by Paul and we'd have conversations about the material. But before there was a kind of critical mass, it was hard to really start generating annotations. And so the project became more and more collaborative over time. And then the last couple of years, it was the two of us doing largely the same work of editing and annotating and discussing annotations and working on various philological issues. We spent a lot of time on Marx's quotations and looking at how they differ from the source material. In other words, Marx had a kind of creative quoting style, and we try to make all his changes to the source material transparent for readers. And sometimes there are very interesting questions about what he was actually doing. He translated a lot of English primary material into German for the body of the text. He leaves a lot of things in foreign languages in the footnotes. And there are cases, many cases, where, again, it's a little hard to tell what's going on. Is Marx translating boldly? He had a freewheeling style of translation. Or is he maybe massaging the evidence a little bit? And I can make this concrete with an example. In an English factory inspector's report, there's the line, "The smell was almost unbearable." And Marx drops the "almost." And okay, so now it seems maybe a little worse. The smell is unbearable. That's what the German says. It could be just a mistake. Marx makes mistakes in the book. You know, he took on a big project, and of course, with something like that, and he didn't have any kind of editorial help or research assistance or anything. So of course, mistakes are going to be made. It could be he was thinking that this "almost" was a kind of British understatement that doesn't translate well into English. So in order to match what's in the source text, you have to drop this word. That could well be. Or it could be that he's trying to amplify the factory inspector's report a little bit to make the industrial conditions sound even worse than the factory inspectors made them out to be, which is something that he clearly does in some cases. There are some cases where that's unambiguous. So we spent a lot of time working on these kinds of questions together.
How does the change in the translation reflect political and cultural changes since, you know, the more common one 50 years ago, the old, more Abilene one is what, 100 years old or more? How does the evolution of politics affect how you go about this business of translation?
Well, I think there's a number of ways that the translation speaks to a different time. You know, it's very subtle. It's subtle and not so subtle the ways it does that. So, for example, we are now in a what is arguably in many ways a post-socialist global political scene. There are communisms or things that call themselves communisms that are still going. communism with Chinese characteristics. But those kind of classical Marxist-Leninist socialisms have pretty much come to an end. And so the translation tries to open up a lot of other aspects of the text, which were always there, but didn't get the kind of translational attention that they're getting in this one. For example, the way capitalists are not the culprit. They may be the enemy in class struggle. Maybe that's useful politically. But in the book, capitalists are functions of the machine, the automatic subject, Marx calls it.
Personifications of capital, right? Is that...
It's not missing in the last translation, but it's made much clearer by a vocabulary that lets the capitalists be functions of the system. So function is a word that Marx uses. He also uses personification. And one thing that doesn't come up in Fauchs's translation, but is actually in the German and now translated, is the phrase, which I take to be the most important one in the new translation, the automatic subject, which is the capital system itself.
Could it be geeky and ask what the German was?
Some of the translation moves, that it's almost embarrassing, that people are making a lot of, are very straightforward translations that for whatever reason weren't translated straightforwardly before. I'm pretty sure it's just automatisches Subjekt. So it's a very direct translation.
Yeah, that's pretty cognate.
If you leave that out, you're left without the real enemy, which is a kind of supra or super individual subject that isn't personal. It's an impersonal automatic system that has to personify itself in certain characters to pretend like it's still a social system like we recognize. So this leads to a whole other political thinking.
Just to add a little bit to that, so one quite concrete difference that relates in a very direct way to what Paul just said is that both Moore Aveling and Fauchs sometimes translate capital as capitalist, when capital is doing things that, well, you would expect a person to do. And I don't do that at all. Capital is always driving the action, where Marx has it drive the action, not the capitalist.
And it's really true that this particular social form doesn't allow for free decision-making by anyone, including the capitalists. This first book, but even more with Volume 3, shows how capitalists are under tremendous pressures to keep exploiting workers. The pressures come from competition and from the very mechanism of the capital system, which is having to produce surplus value.
Yeah, competition telling the capitalists to march, march, right?
Yep.
We're listening to an interview with Paul North, editor, and Paul Reiter, translator and also editor, of a new edition of Volume 1 of Marx's Capital for Princeton University Press. Paul North, in your intro, you have a useful passages where you situate Marx in the field, then known as political economy, now we call it economics. That change of terminology is in itself significant, but talk a little bit about his relation to the classical economists and then what came afterwards.
Well, he was a Hegelian, which meant that he loved philosophy. He thought history worked by a kind of logic and that most of the particulars of history could be fit into that. Now, this is when he's, what, 22. By the time he's 25, he discovers that the situation of a lot of people, even in ideal states like England or Prussia, which were by no means ideal, but presented themselves that way, the situation of workers, for example, was horrible. So how do you explain this? Well, you go to a discourse, a science, that actually studies the living conditions of people. And that was political economy. Its great practitioners, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, Thomas Malthus, he read through those, and then he read through all the others around them who took this up and started investigating how economies really worked, how money moved around. And that changed the basis for a philosophical account of society. He had to start from the economic basis and move to the logic of the society from there. So he mined political economy, but he also critiqued it because he thought it had too narrow categories, was too rosy about the outcome, and didn't really understand fully the ills of this manufacturing economy, this factory economy that it was celebrating.
Yeah, and you opened by saying he was really driven by anger, although he sublimates that into his analysis. But it's prose. It still often reflects an anger.
He was very good at being pissed off. He was very good at ridiculing people, at insulting them. And what I learned from Reiter's translation, where he brings out all these different tonal shifts in the text, is that Marx didn't really care if Capital fell because you did good dialectics and critiqued it, or because you insulted its main theoreticians. He was happy to take down the cheap, unthinking political economists, as he was happy to take down other political thinkers of his day. He never really attacked capitalists because they have no choice.
Although there is some movement there too, Marx makes it very clear that this is not meant as a moralizing critique of capitalism. And at times he talks about the extraordinary cheap sentimentality that sees things that way. How the system works does not depend on the will of the individual capitalist, whether it's good or bad. That's pretty much a direct quotation. But there are times when capitalists are squeezing workers in excess of what capitalism normally does. And there are cases, particularly in chapter 8, the Working Day chapter, where he cites English factory inspectors' reports at length and talks quite a bit about abuses of child workers, where he's clearly outraged and he calls out individuals as being just nefarious characters who deserve public censure and more.
His outrage in chapter 8, which is a brilliant chapter that could be a book on its own, called The Working Day. He's certainly outraged by the idea of child labor, which wasn't actually abolished under the age of 14 in England until 1933. So it had a long way to go. What he's most outraged about is how the capitalists try to get around the law in order to keep their practices going. He was a great angry critic, Marx.
Paul Reiter, in your interview with Scott McLemay, you discussed the contrast between Marx's style and the German norms of the time. Could you talk about that?
I know that this translation will perhaps sound like it's trying to make Marx's prose sound more modern. And I suppose compared to the other translations, it does sound more modern. So it's natural to think that way. But I'm really trying here to translate what I hear when I read Marx. And Marx's prose is quite different from German scholarly writing of the mid-late 19th century, where you have, it's not like Marx's sentences are always short. There are long sentences, but they're long sentences generally that build up to some kind of powerful punchline sort of thing. I'm not necessarily talking about a joke. I'm talking about maybe a big reveal or some line that's meant to be seen as an indictment of something. Often he'll use what's called in German a Gedankenstrich. Here it's an M dash, but the Gedankenstrich has a weightier feel to it than that in German to separate the last word or words of one of these long sentences. But he also has a lot of short sentences where the word order is subject, verb, object. German is a language where you can have the finite verb, the conjugated verb, go to the end of a clause. And it's a very English-sounding word order. Therefore, if you read the first couple of pages in German, it's almost all like that. That's very unusual for this kind of writing. There's a pithiness, a concision, a vigor to it that Engels saw as unique in German letters and talked about, therefore, in superlative terms that makes it feel like it's not quite of its moment. And I do think that Marx thought, like Nietzsche, he was going for a certain untimeliness. He was a great contextualizer and always connecting ideas to material circumstances, which is actually not something that was done as a matter of course at the time. And that's one of the ways in which we're all sort of Marxists now. But I think he was trying to write a book for future audiences.
There are a couple of challenges for rendering German into English, many of them, but here are just two. The German practice of stringing nouns together into neologisms, which sounds very natural to someone who speaks German, but sounds strange or almost comical to an English speaker sometimes. And then the word order, notably putting the verb or often several verbs at the end of a sentence. Adorno said this allowed one to hold concepts in suspension for most of the sentence until he could resolve them at the end. How do you handle these things? For the nouns, do you paraphrase them, direct translate the string of nouns? And for the verbs, well, what do you do about the verb order?
Yeah, Mark Twain had a different kind of comment about them.
Yes.
It always, of course, depends on the case. It's not like I have just one strategy that I apply everywhere. In some cases, a lot of cases, I do translate Marx's compound nouns as compound nouns with a hyphen, but there are cases where it doesn't seem necessary to do that, and so I don't. Paul talked about the movement of Marx's prose, how he's always changing registers, and abstract nouns sit a bit more heavily in English than they do in German. And so if you're translating noun to noun, then the language becomes heavier. And when you're translating German scholarly writing into English, it tends to sound more technical in the translation. Freud is the great example, but there are lots of other examples, and there are a number of reasons for that. And if you're interested in talking further about that, I'm happy to. But the point here is simply that if you translate in always in a very direct noun-to-noun way, or using or according to the conventions of German to English philosophical translation, then the writing is going to get heavier. And in the case of someone like Marx, where there are a lot of changes of register, the changes of register are not going to feel like refreshing movement or movement that somehow mimics the object of inquiry. They're going to feel like crazy stylistic lurches. And so for that reason, I did do quite a bit of retranslating nouns into something else, some kind of verb phrase. But I was very careful about that because, of course, it's important to keep the technical terminology together. And so I spent a lot of time deciding how to translate Marx's nouns. As to the word order, Capital, when people talk about the literary qualities of Capital, they very often mention that Marx uses the term vampire and werewolf, and there are Gothic elements to the writing. For me, one of the main elements of literariness here is the rhythm. I think Marx is a rhythm writer. And you can't just follow the German word order and hope to match what Marx is doing with the language. You have to give yourself a lot of freedom there. And so I did a fair amount of reordering. In German, you can emphasize something by putting it at the end of a sentence. There's a lot of backloading. In English, you can emphasize something by putting it at the front of the sentence. I did some of that. There were cases where it did feel like there was a kind of conceptual development going on within the sentence on the sentence level, and it was important to have a longer sentence with the verb at the end. So I did that as well. You'll see a mix of strategies in the translation. There are, if you compared the German to the translation, you would see that some sentences are broken up, that there's reordering, but that there's also the reproduction of some longer sentences that follow the German syntax pretty closely.
Marx's style generally must make it a challenge both for editor and translator. It's like Paul North notes his disciplinary eclecticism, philosophy, economics, sociology, it's just poetry, it's all there. But that shows up in his prose, the works he cites from, you know, Pindar in one page and a factory inspector report in the next. It's a dazzling text. And I think a lot of people who haven't read much Marx don't really appreciate precisely how great a stylist he was.
There's a great quote from a pamphlet from the 1930s trying to explain Capital, which says, one out of 100,000 Marxists have read Capital, and zero out of 100,000 anti-Marxists have read Capital. So a lot of its treasures remain hidden, and they remained hidden in the previous translation because missing the ear for these different styles and moves, and also for the tremendous integration of disciplines that Marx undertakes. He was not a scholar. He didn't have any disciplinary restrictions. And I think he thought everyone in history had something to say potentially about this new thing that came over the horizon, industrial capitalism. And he was going to mine them all. They all had insights. And he didn't care if it was Pindar or Adam Smith.
Living out the principles he establishes in the chapter on the labor process, where he draws on Schiller quite a bit, as Paul points out in some excellent annotations. And he talks about how the labor process at its best involves the free play of our mental powers. And he's allowing himself to do that here in this. He talks a lot about specialization and the narrowness it involves and the deformation that takes place under conditions of extreme specialization. Well, his book models something else in its radical multidisciplinarity.
Okay, and finally, there are hundreds of thousands who haven't read Capital. Do a little salesmanship. What about your translation makes it more approachable or more attractive for a contemporary audience?
I'll say a couple of things and then I'll let Paul talk. I have to admit that self-promotion is not my natural mode, but I'll give it a shot. I do think that this translation stylistically is a lot more engaging than the previous translations. I talk in the translator's preface about some of the pressures that the previous translators labored under, especially the first translation. I think that you can do a lot of different things with translation and that sometimes it makes sense to go for a formal equivalence style that communicates how the lexical design of the original text is, but there's a cost there. I think there's quite a bit of that in Fowkes, but there's a cost there. And the cost is that the prose is not going to move in the way that the source text does. And in the case of Marx, because the movement is so important and so engaging and thrilling even at times, that's a big loss. At the same time, Fowkes, for various reasons having to do with political context, was just not that interested in certain aspects of the conceptual architecture that are very important for understanding Marx's argument about value, which is at the center of things. Crucial parts of the text for understanding Marx's argument about value will make more sense in my translation.
Here you get a chance to see why, no matter how much you work, you're not getting ahead. And the translation allows you to hear Marx's voice speaking much more directly about these things. And the great hope we have for getting better lives, for slowing climate change or reversing climate change, for changing how much we're pressured to do things we don't want to do, is to understand our situation. So this book is still the key to life in a capital system for people who are earning wages.
Those are Paul North and Paul Reiter. North is an editor and writer and editor and translator of the first volume of Marx's Capital, just out from Princeton University Press. They're working on the other two volumes of Capital now. I thought it might be rude to ask them when those would be coming out. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Humanoid Fruit, a new release by the German DJ Helena Hauff. What has happened to the political culture of Israel in the year since the October 7th attacks? Always bellicose and prone to vengeful outbursts, the country looks to have become even more so. With more, here are two Israeli expatriates now living in Berlin, a common destination for people who find their homeland politically unbearable. Nimrod Flaschenberg is a former Knesset staffer and campaigner for Hadash, a coalition of left parties in Israel, and one of the founders of the Berlin-based group Israelis for Peace. Alma Itzhaki is an Israeli artist and scholar, and also one of the founders of that group. Their article, How October 7th Transformed Israeli Society, is on the Jacobin magazine website. Nimrod Flaschenberg and Alma Itzhaki. To be blunt about it, there's a feeling on the Western left, maybe unstated, that to acknowledge Israelis' pain over the deaths last October 7th is to yield too much to the Zionists. Please sort this out for us.
I think acknowledging the pain and the horrors of October 7th is something that we as Israelis, we all feel as like this terrible pain that's been troubling us and piercing our entire existence and our entire life for the past year. That does not in any way cover up for the crimes that Israel has been committing since October 7th and before. But I think that to understand that the Israeli left and that people in Israel need to do political action, political work to change the reality is also an element in the solution that we all want, which is a peaceful existence of these two people in that place. So giving up on Israelis as an actor with all of the terrible things that are happening to Israeli society, I just think is not an option. And that includes also recognizing their experience.
For us on the Israeli left, it's also been very, very difficult the way this pain and mourning and grief have been weaponized and used as a propaganda tool and in very, you know, gross manners in Israeli media and abroad. But yes, I think as Nimrod said, we can't, as long as we want to talk to Israelis, recognizing their pain, their anxiety, we must do this, and it's right to do that.
Before October 7th, there had been growing rebellion against Netanyahu's regime. That looks to have dissipated, right? That anti-Netanyahu feeling within Israeli politics, is that all gone?
It's not all gone. It's very perplexing and for me, like, extremely frustrating because the anti-Netanyahu feelings are still very much there, even more than before October 7. I mean, if before October 7 people thought that Netanyahu was corrupt and criminal and extreme right, now he's held responsible for the greatest calamity, greatest catastrophe in Israeli history. He's held responsible for allowing October 7, failing to prevent it and failing to take responsibility. But still, with all this anger and fear of the government, really, people are not protesting because many of them support the war, sadly.
There's also very intense police repression. I mean, I've seen some clips of brutal police beatings and such from anybody making the slightest objection to the war. But you've got what? Ben-Gavir is running the police and Smotrich arming settlers. It seems like an extremely oppressive environment, repressive environment.
Yes, it is. I mean, there were many fears of Ben-Gavir being made Minister of National Security. It used to be called Inner Security before he changed it. Because he made no secret about his intentions to move the police to support his camp. And he made very quickly after his appointment a round of appointments in the top commanding position in the police, appointing his loyalist as the commander of the police and the chief of the Tel Aviv district. And so the increased suppression began before. And after October 7, there was very, very brutal oppression, mostly of Palestinian opposition, affecting Palestinian opposition much more than Jewish. So there were massive arrests of Palestinians, mostly for social media posts, some of activists, some of people who are not even activists, with also, the state attorney approving very prolonged arrest periods for suspected or detained people. And yes, so I think that there's a very strong atmosphere of fear and silencing, especially in the Palestinian public. But it should be said that I don't think this is why there are no protests. I think that, you know, with all this being said, there's still a possibility to protest. It is not very, if you organize and go out to the street, your condition is still not entirely different from other Western countries. And so sadly, I think this oppression does not explain the lack of protest.
There is protest. It's just that the protest is about the hostages, which are very important, and the demand for their release is very important. But In a sense, the centrality of the hostages to the discourse of the opposition to Netanyahu has pushed aside all of the anti-war sentiments that still existed in Israel in some areas of society. And in a sense, now they're completely marginalized. It came to a really acute situation a few weeks ago after the killing of the six hostages when a banner was put up in one of those big demonstrations that were, you know, expressions of rage that said, first we get them back, the hostages, and then we go back to war. So this mentality of like rallying around the flag and the army and the endless war campaign of Netanyahu is something that is quite pervasive even in the anti-Netanyahu camp.
You write in the Jacobin article, an entire society is behind this massacre, this eradication of an entire place. I read some appalling comments on social media from Israelis and their sympathizers abroad that boil down to, let's flatten Gaza and kill all the Palestinians. That's not an uncommon sentiment, right? So what happened in Israeli society that makes this possible?
Yeah, you need to divide it into like three different moments in a sense. Obviously, there is the entire history of Zionism and exclusion of Palestinians. And Israel was always a belligerent country that had like this ethos, anti-Arab racism and so on. This is there and it's in the ground. It's in the history. It's in the settler colonial elements of Israel as a place. And then you need to look at the shorter time frame of, let's say, the last 20 to 30 years, when the extreme right actually did its very intensive march through the institutions of Israeli society and Israeli state in order to take control. And this is something that happened under Netanyahu, but it also involved like the takeover of settlers and religious fanatics of different elements of Israeli society. And then you had October 7 as like this tinderbox that exploded and that brought out the ugliest and most egregious forms of racism, of genocidal incitement, and so on in Israeli society. I didn't expect it to be so much across the board, but in a sense, the way both the ruling class and the media in Israel are using the events of that day in order to indoctrinate the society into this vengeful position also plays an element. We saw it most of all yesterday in the when it was the 1 year mark for October 7th. But Israeli media is constantly repeating and replaying that day, that terrible day, and ignores everything that happened afterwards. And if they do talk about Gaza, if they do talk about Lebanon, then the civilian population is unaccounted for.
I would like to add something maybe that I think apart from these three moments that Nimrod described, there is also a specific element concerning Gaza. I think that within the general dehumanization of Palestinians in Israel, there is a particularly strong erasing of Gaza from consciousness that began also long before October 7th. It was actually since the Oslo agreements and when the Gaza was the first to be handed over to the Palestinian Authority, and then even more so since the disengagement, so-called disengagement, the tactical removal of settlements on 2005 and the Hamas election power there. Israel has been governing Gaza from outside and ruling over its population and most aspects of life there, but there is no connection with anything going on inside Gaza for the vast, vast majority of Israelis, even more so than in the West Bank. And there's no representation of Gazan life, civilians in the media, not in times of peace, not in times of, or not peace, not in times of, you know, inactive fighting, and definitely not now. The Israelis are not seeing almost any of the photos, the videos, the reports of what is actually happening in Gaza.
Anybody who signs on to Twitter or X, if you want to use the barbarism, will see, you know, the most horrific videos of exploded bodies and flattened neighborhoods and all. But is that not visible in Israel? I mean, is it not literally physically visible, leaving aside any psychological barriers to seeing what's going on?
I think not. Most people, at least in Israel, still get their news from the television, and the television is not showing any of this. Also, you know, social media tends to create these echo chambers where what you see on Twitter is not what an Israeli will see if he goes on Twitter. I don't think that Israeli don't know. The cold facts are there. They are reported in the media. People know that millions are being starved, that there's no medical treatment or vaccinations, medicines, and that, you know, the mass of destruction and killing, but it's not visually present, it's not emotionally present, it's not told as stories of individual people, it's just numbers.
Yeah, I think there's also like this aestheticization of destruction that is happening in the way Gaza is perceived. Like, people are rejoicing at the rubble in Gaza. Let's say Israel's most famous and most important journalist, Amit Segal, his Telegram page is filled with explosions in Gaza, but there are never people there. There is rubble and there is Hamas terrorists as like this boogeyman, and there are no people.
That was the voice of Nimrod Flaschenberg, co-author of an article along with Alma Itzhaki, whom we're also hearing from, about Israel a year after the October 7th attacks. You also say in the piece that the ideal of the warmongers is a Jewish Sparta on the eastern Mediterranean, a nation of warriors under God's guidance, waging a holy and eternal crusade against the Arabs. That is really a chilling vision of a society.
Definitely, it is chilling for us as Israelis on the left. I think it is also chilling for just, you know, mainstream liberal Israelis. But this is the result of the process of the past 20 years. The fact that the two most extreme politicians of the settler movement are now in power, the Kahanist Ben-Gvir and the religious Zionist Smotrich, are now like holding power and are actually the core of the ideological engine of Netanyahu's government, just means that this is the project that is being pursued. Before October 7th, we also discussed it here, there was this mass movement against the takeover of the extreme right, and it was about the judicial issue and the high-tech nation and so on and so forth. It was about like Israel's self-perception as a liberal place. And I think that in many ways, the Israeli mainstream or center-left or however you want to call it, just gave up and completely accepted the militarized vision. So it's not that they all turned religious in a moment, not at all. But they're accepting the premise of a forever war. They're accepting the premise of, you know, enlarging the IDF. They're accepting the premise that an attack in Lebanon is necessary, and they're accepting the premise that attacking Iran is necessary. So even if they don't like the aesthetics of this extreme right-wing, religious, fanatic vision, they're accepting the main tenets of it.
This is a society being designed for a permanent war. Expand the military. There's a sense now that they were too reliant on technology, and you need much more of old-fashioned arms buildup and more people in uniform. This is going to have a terrible effect on the society and a massive economic burden to have this permanent war mobilization. Where will this lead?
Yes, I think like the Israeli economy is very strong. It's an export-based economy that's based on the high-tech market, but also on arms and on export of natural gas. It has many, many things to work with. I think there is a vision of this belligerent existence as with a sustainable economy, but it's not going to be anything close to what we became used to in the past 20 years, because eventually there will be some estrangement from the international community as well. You know, notwithstanding the support that Biden and Olaf Scholz are giving Netanyahu and his devastation campaign in Gaza, I think in the long run, if Israel continues in this way, the international community will push it aside in many aspects. And then it will have this economic model built just on arms, gas, and so on. And that obviously cannot sustain the same high-tech economy that we have now. But the other side of this is that people are living. Many people I know, as well as myself, but many people I know in Israel are considering leaving the country because they don't want to live or to raise their kids in this Sparta, as we called it in the piece. These are, you know, academics, these are doctors, these are high-tech people, because, you know, in Israel, many have foreign passports, many have connections abroad. It's a very well-integrated society into the global economy and society. So there are other options, and many are taking them. And they're going to leave, you know, the Palestinians and the extreme right, settlers and ultra-Orthodox and so on. So in a sense, it's going to make Israeli society and Israeli demography even more rightward leaning.
Bibi Netanyahu didn't come out of nowhere. There's a direct link from him back to Menachem Begin and through Begin to Jabotinsky. There's something within the original Zionist project that made this all possible, right? The early Zionists were very clear. They were colonizers who'd evoked the hatred of the Palestinians. They were displacing. It's a nation born in an act of violent mass displacement, the Nakba. So why this current war situation seems like turns for the worse, it's always been there, hasn't it?
Yes, I think it's always been there. It's true that the Zionist project is based on ethnic cleansing and displacement of the Palestinians and on settling on their land. And in a way, yes, what we're seeing now is a second Nakba, in the sense that the plans for expulsion and annexation that are happening now are something that was definitely not possible, definitely not 10 years ago or not last year. I mean, there are very concrete talks in the government of conquering, maybe resettling parts of Gaza. I mean, conquering in the sense of a permanent military presence there. And the direction of Bezalel Smotrich is a de facto annexation of the West Bank that we already see happening, with the displacement of many Palestinian community and the gradual integration of all civil administration in the West Bank into the Israeli government instead of the military regime. So it's true that there's a line there, but there were many years in between where there seemed to be other possibilities, or there was a status quo and there was contestation about where will this go next. And now, horribly, it looks like there's a decision.
There were many forks in the road, and maybe excluding one short period in the 90s, Israel has always taken the wrong turn in an ethical political sense. Now we are seeing something that is completely unprecedented. And I think it's important to look at the scale of devastation and to understand that this was made possible because this is the government in power. And this government in power does not represent all of Zionist history, all of Israeli history, and so on. Ethnic cleansing was always there, but I insist that it could have gone to different directions, and that this, what is happening now in Gaza, is not a necessary outgrowth of everything that happened in the past 80 years. It's also not a good political understanding, this like totalizing notion of seeing inherently inside the political project all of its expressions. So there could have been other choices made. And I insist to think that maybe there could be other choices in the future, that both Israelis and Palestinians could live in a different way. It doesn't look very likely, but we as Israelis, and I think also Palestinians, need to still believe in a sense that it's possible.
Now, you've talked about this some, but people who think like you are leaving the country. And it's going to leave behind some of the worst elements in the society. A Facebook friend posted some evidence that it's hard to get a seat on a flight from Tel Aviv to New York. And if you can, the fare is something like $5,000. How important is this exodus? And what's it going to do to the rest of society? It's just going to make it even more right-wing?
First of all, I think the prices issue is because international airlines are not flying to Israel because there's a war with Lebanon. Or in Lebanon.
Yeah, I think LL is the only one making the flight.
Yeah. I'm flying to Israel tomorrow on an LL flight. Every other company canceled their flights. But yeah, there is an exodus. And we're seeing it around us, especially, you know, as leftists. Our circles of friends are filled with people that are looking for ways out. I think it's very significant. The numbers are not that clear, but it's very clear the identities of the people who are leaving. What is it going to do? I don't know in the long run. I mean, it's very frightening. And as Israelis who do not live there, you also feel guilt because not being there, you're not taking part in the struggle on the ground. So it's difficult and there's no good answer for that.
Okay, so is there a way out of all this? You say in the article that international pressure is the only hope, but it's hard to see that coming from the U.S. The money will become increasingly important to funding a war economy. Israel, without American support of that sort, Israel would have a very hard time conducting its wars. Sometimes it looks like it from a distance that Israel could just kind of explode from all the rage, but that doesn't seem imminent either. Is there any way out of this permanent war?
As we said in the article, the only way also to change Israeli society is to make it clear that there is cost for this. You know, international pressure is not only a way for stopping the armament. And then, you know, the army, the Israeli army could not do what it's doing. But it's also showing Israelis that this path cannot, you know, be sustainable in the international arena. Until now, this prospect has failed utterly. I think most of all because of the American Democratic administration that has been just appalling and totally supportive of Israel. I think in many ways, like the question reverts back to the U.S. and to political processes that could be done there, because the empire is the center of gravity of this project of endless war. And only a change in American perspective could really bend the Israelis. Even if the Europeans are going to turn in a different direction, the linkage between Washington and Jerusalem is the key element. So it's your job in many ways.
Alma, do you want to have the last word?
No, just say I'm not an expert on this at all, but I have been reading and talking to people that saying that the last year has changed the legal situation and diplomatic situation, that this will have not maybe an immediate influence, but it will definitely have a far-reaching influence on Israel's stand in the international scene, at least in Europe. I mean, we are hearing this from politicians in Germany that the ICJ case, the decision, the recent decision in the UN about the illegality of the occupation, these will definitely have some influence about the possibility even to support Israel.
Those are Nimrod Flaschenberg and Alma Itzhaki, authors of an article, How October 7th Transformed Israeli Society, on the Jacobin website. It's often hard to distinguish between broad historical and structural trends and turns for the worse in immediate circumstances. In the case of Israel's current round of destructive fury, some of it has always been there, and some of it reflects the rise of an extreme right and the marginalization of everyone else. Or maybe another way of reading things is that the inner essence has burst into view for all to see. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the first movement of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 14, performed by the Yale Quartet. Till next week, bye. Thank you.